Our first matter of the day is Grimicioni versus the Department of Law and Public Safety. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Robin B. Geigel, G-I-G-L, from the firm of Luck Allrath, for the appellants, Monmouth County Prosecutor's Office, Prosecutor Grimicioni, former Assistant Prosecutors Gregory Schwiers, Jacqueline Seely, and Richard Necromona.
Good morning, Your Honors. Daniel Vanella, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Department of Law and Public Safety.
Welcome, counsel. Thank you for joining us virtually. Ms. Geigel, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal if
yes.
I need it? Thank you, Your
yes.
Honor. May it please the court. Before the court today are four consolidated appeals that all arise out of a federal lawsuit involving the murder of a woman by her ex-husband, who at the time he committed the murder was a Neptune police officer. The issue before the court is whether the conduct alleged in the various federal complaints that were filed, and I'll kind of go through that federal procedural history because it's relevant to this appeal. The issues raised against the Monmouth County prosecutor defendants, which I will call all my clients for purposes of this argument, the issues were that they failed to investigate the allegations against Philip Seidel, the then police officer. They failed to seize his weapon. They returned his weapon when they shouldn't have. They allowed him to retain his weapon. And they fail to properly supervise and train law enforcement personnel. And so the issue before the court is whether that conduct that's alleged in those various complaints is law enforcement under this court's ruling in Wright versus State, and therefore, if it is, entitled the Monmouth County Prosecutor Office defendants would be entitled to representation and indemnification by the Attorney General's office. At the center of this case is a law enforcement directive issued in 2000 by the then Attorney General dealing with domestic violence incidences involving law enforcement officers. That directive, which is entitled a Directive Implementing Procedure from Municipal County Enforcement Officers Involving Domestic Violence Issues, states that the directive is to be followed by county prosecutors when handling local and county law enforcement officers involved in domestic violence incidents. So that's at the center of this case. The case gets a little bit more complicated because of the procedural posture of the federal case. So what happens in the federal case is that there's an original complaint that's filed in June of 2017, and it makes various allegations against the Neptune Police Department, the Asbury Park Police Department, and the Monmouth County Prosecutor Office defendants. That is then sent to the Attorney General's office with a request that there be indemnification, defense and indemnification pursuant to Wright. And the Attorney General's office sends a letter that said, we're going to defend and indemnify on certain issues in the case, but we're not going to defend and indemnify on others. That is the original sin in this case. And I'll come back to that and talk about why. But procedurally, what then happens is that even before that complaint in the federal court is dealt with, there's an amended complaint filed. And for our purposes, all that does is it adds the assistant prosecutor defendants that I represent in this matter. So we have a complaint and an amended complaint pending in the federal court. And on April 19th of 2018, Judge Michael Shipp, who has that case in the federal court, dismisses the amended complaint, and that his decision is part of our appellate appendix at page 144. And in dismissing it, he dismisses prejudice all claims dealing with law enforcement and investigative functions engaged in by the Monmouth County Prosecutor Office defendants. And he didn't specify what those particular allegations in the complaint were, but he dismissed them with prejudice. Following that, there's a second amended complaint filed in May of 2018. And
Can I stop you for one moment?
Sure.
Judge Shipp dismissed the claim on what basis? Did he do it on the basis of 11th Amendment immunity or prosecutorial immunity? Do you know?
I believe it was both, actually, Judge. Justice. I can fish for his opinion if you want me to, but my recollection is that he said that in terms of state action, so that it would be the constitutional claim, he found that it was state action, but he also found that there was qualified immunity under the right analysis, that this was law enforcement conduct. So without specifying what it was that he was dismissing, my understanding, Justice, is that he dismissed it on both grounds.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So what happens when we send the second amended complaint to the Attorney General's office is that despite the fact that the second amended complaint contains basically the exact same allegations that were in complaints, the original complaint and the amended complaint, the Attorney General says, no, Judge Shipp dismissed everything that's law enforcement. We're not doing anything. And if your honors look to the appellate division decision in this matter at pages 17 and 18, there's a chart that shows the various allegations and how they flow from the complaint to the amended complaint and to the second amended complaint, just being renumbered as they go along. And so the Attorney General says, we're not covering anything. That becomes appeal number three. And on December 11th, 2018, Judge Shipp again dismisses the second amended complaint. And in dismissing that, it's just a very short letter saying the second amended complaint really didn't cure the defects in the amended complaint, and he's dismissing it. But he cautions plaintiff's counsel that he has dismissed all claims against the Monmouth County Prosecutor's Office and Prosecutor Grimuccioni with prejudice. And again, that letter opinion is in the joint second supplementary appendix that was filed by the parties in the appellate division. Judge Shipp gives plaintiff's counsel in the federal case the last bite at the apple, so to speak, and a third amended complaint is filed on January 25th. It's 143 pages long. It's 738 paragraphs long. And again, when we send it to the Attorney General's office for coverage and defense, the Attorney General, again, denies that it owes any duty to defend any portion of it. Not surprising.
May I ask you a question about that, the third amended complaint? There's a paragraph 47, in which plaintiffs assert that the prosecutors were acting in an administrative capacity as opposed to a law enforcement or investigatory function. To what extent does that control in a case like this?
Your Honor, you anticipated my next sentence of my argument, which was that they put that in there. And I don't think it has any controlling weight. I mean, you have a situation where a court has said, I'm dismissing anything that's law enforcement. Well, a good plaintiff's lawyer is going to say, well, this isn't law enforcement. But it doesn't matter what the plaintiff calls it. It matters what it is and what it is under Wright and under Lavezzi, not how a plaintiff's attorney wants to characterize it. So
paragraph that the chief just read,
yes, Your Honor,
tells me that Wright is affecting or even perverting the way plaintiff's civil rights attorneys are filing their complaints. As as a result of right, the plaintiffs know that if it's administrative, it will apply to the county. The county is not subject to 11th Amendment immunity. The county is a person under 1983, and the state has 11th Amendment immunity and is not a person. So the attorneys now, in framing their 1983 complaints, are looking to right and this divide that it's made, and now it's implicating also the payment. It seems to me to have had a really unintended consequence. Am I off about that?
I don't think you are, Your Honor. Although I would note in this case, it took basically two direct warnings from Judge Shipp for plaintiff's counsel in the underlying case to get the message and put in the language that the Chief Justice read. But yes, you're correct. I think plaintiff's counsels are picking up on that. And that's why I think it's important that there be independent review by the Attorney General's office and then perhaps ultimately by the courts to go through and make a decision, regardless of what a plaintiff counsel calls something, as to whether or not it's law enforcement and is covered by right, as opposed to just going by what a plaintiff's counsel puts in a complaint. Because as Your Honor correctly points out, any smart plaintiff's counsel, knowing that they will have their complaint dismissed on 11th Amendment grounds, isn't going to look for going after the state. And if under right, if it's law enforcement, this court has held that it's state action and therefore covered by the federal courts, therefore say it's covered by the 11th Amendment. So I agree with Your Honor.
Turn to some of the particular allegations then. You have, for example, the allegation that there was failure to follow the Attorney General directive. Speak to that. Tell us your position on AG directives and whether they're subject to indemnification in all matters if they're not followed.
Your Honor, I don't think that every Attorney General directive makes something law enforcement. I think this one does, and I would say, you know, as in any case, you have to examine the particular facts to determine whether or not a directive is law enforcement. So, for example, a directive on OPRA and what someone should do in terms of following OPRA, I don't think would be a law enforcement directive. But in this particular case, the law, the number one, it's entitled the law enforcement directive. But more importantly, the Attorney General in issuing it says, when law enforcement officers are charged with committing acts of domestic violence, it is important that matters be uniformly and expeditiously handled. To achieve these objectives, it is necessary that there be a statewide policy governing the seizure of weapons from a law enforcement officer who is charged with committing an act of domestic violence.
I think, Ms. Geigel, one of the things that makes this a close case to me is that it's not the Attorney General's directive on responding to domestic violence statewide. It's the Attorney General's directive on responding to domestic violence incidents involving law enforcement. And obviously the counties have interactions with law enforcement that are perhaps more of a close of a gray area on this. So, would you address where, obviously you're arguing that it falls on the side of law enforcement, but how do we address the fact that this directive is specifically aimed at police officers when they are involved or allegedly involved in domestic violence?
Your Honor, I believe that what the directive is to, while it's broadly to all law enforcement agencies, it's specifically to county prosecutors and how county prosecutors handle incidents of domestic violence involving law enforcement officers within their jurisdiction. So it's a directive to the county prosecutors with specific details as to what they are to do in each particular case. So this is not something that county government can get involved in. This is something that the Attorney General, using his supervisory authority over law enforcement, is saying, this is what you will do when you have an incident of domestic violence involving a law enforcement officer in your county.
So let's take the failure to seize a weapon. Now, that is a very important allegation in a civil rights suit for showing failure to supervise or a practice customer policy. But what does it have to do with the investigation or prosecution of a case? And this is the divide, it may not be a clean divide, that Wright made. What does it have to do with anything that involves the actual prosecution or investigation of a matter?
First of all, Your Honor, I would say it involves the investigation of whether or not there could be a case. But again, respectfully, I think I disagree a little bit with Your Honor in terms of what Wright is intended to cover. I don't think Wright was intended to be limited to basically, you know, what would fall under either absolute or qualified immunity in the federal sense. I think Wright is broader than that. I think there's three criteria that Wright put forward that would make something for purposes of the New Jersey Tort Claims Act and therefore make the prosecutor a state actor and subject to coverage. I think those three criteria are: the prosecutor must be discharging a state function delegated to the county prosecutors by the legislature. In this case, acting as the chief law enforcement officer of the county, going back to Justice Patterson's question, you know, this is a directive to the county prosecutor saying you will do this. The second criteria is that the county prosecutor has to be acting pursuant or under the AG's supervisory authority with the Attorney General's power to supersede. That too is part of the directive. The Attorney General is saying, I'm doing this as part of my supervisory authority, and I'm superseding anything else that's going on in your county, and you will do this. And then the final thing is that the county government plays no role. So that, to me, those are the three criteria of Wright. And here, in terms of this directive, again, county government has absolutely no control over what the Attorney General is telling the county prosecutor to do and what the county prosecutor then does in return. This is
on your second of the three factors, which is that the prosecutor is acting under the AG's supervisory authority and the superseding. Wouldn't that include the Oprah situation when the Attorney General issues a directive and says, we want everybody to uniformly respond to Oprah, and this is how you're going to do it? Wouldn't that be pursuant to that same power to supersede? And if so, wouldn't that include all directives?
Your Honor, I think you have to meet all three criteria that
I understand.
That And so while, yes, you might be correct that a directive from the Attorney General saying, here's what I want you to do on an Oprah request, supersedes, but you don't then have the other two criteria, because certainly county government plays a role in responding to Oprah requests, and certainly in terms of the function of a prosecutor, that is not something that's it's not delegated to him by the legislature. It's just the law in general, you know, in terms of all public agencies, you have to comply with this law. So I would say in the situation that you posed, Justice Patterson, that you wouldn't meet all three criteria on Wright, and I do believe you do need to meet all three criteria on Wright. Should I continue with my argument? More questions? Did I answer everyone's question?
Well, when you, counsel, when you identified your three criteria, is this a breakdown of the language that appears in Wright on page 456 I hope I have the right page.
Actually, yeah. Your Honor, I was looking at pages 451 and 452.
Okay.
And I can quote it for you if you want me to.
No, I have it here. I'm just looking. The reason I pointed to 456 is because when the Wright Court was trying to summarize, and the Wright Court said many things in a couple different ways, it seemed to be focusing on the discharge of law enforcement duties, which you have broken down nicely into three categories, but they're not subject to analysis as if they are tied to a specific case or a specific investigation, which would loop in the kind of law enforcement directives such as we have here, but not the kind such as the Oprah example that was given by my colleague Justice Patterson before, which is a more generic obligation on public entities, typically, not something specific to law enforcement duties, regardless of whether it's tied to a one case situation or not. Do you agree with that?
To be honest with Your Honor, I'm not sure I follow Your Honor's question.
I'm reading law enforcement a little bit more broadly, I just want to see if you agree, because you said discharging a state function, acting under the AG's authority to supervise and subject to supersession. Subject to supersession is typically done in the context of a specific case. But I don't think you're requiring there to be a specific case in order for something to be a law enforcement duty. Are you suggesting that?
Now, thank you for clarifying. I do agree with Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, I think the Wright Court intended law enforcement to be viewed broadly. And as I said to Justice Alban, I don't think it's limited to the situations that we see in either a 13th Amendment context an absolute or qualified immunity context. I think under Wright, it's much broader. So I agree with Your Honor.
Okay, so then from that, we now are seeing in this case an example of where complaints have been parsed by paragraph, looking to determine whether or not coverage is going to be provided for this paragraph, but not that paragraph. In one of your briefs, you point out the different position taken by the Attorney General regarding paragraph 64 and 65 in one iteration, where one is a more particularized explanation of the other. It's hard to see a difference. If we view law enforcement duties more broadly, it would preclude, I think, this kind of paragraph by paragraph parsing and look more at the complaint or counts as a whole. Is that what you are asking this court to do in reviewing the Attorney General's decision in this matter?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, you are correct in terms of what we had in our briefs and how this was parsed, where even some clauses within a paragraph are covered, but other clauses within the same paragraph are not covered. And as an attorney who ultimately has to litigate a case, it's a procedural nightmare. How logistically do you handle a case when a paragraph is covered by the Attorney General, but another paragraph or another sentence in the same paragraph isn't covered?
I do not know how that litigation can possibly be managed. So I'm somewhat surprised to see it in this setting. I don't know how, even if counsel had been obtained for outside representation, I don't know how there could have been a coordination between the two counsel in this matter.
Picking up on what Justice Lavecchia has said, I take it your argument is essentially that this involves the enforcement of the Domestic Violence Act against a police officer, and that is law enforcement, and therefore it's subject to indemnification and representation. That's in essence what you're saying. The complaint relates to that.
You are correct, Justice.
Okay. Counsel, would it be very difficult for you representing your client to just fight every allegation, and then depending on what the jury comes back, that'll determine what's covered and isn't later. But as counsel, you defend all claims against your client equally, regardless of whether they're covered in, at the end of the day. That wouldn't make it so difficult, would it? That's done a lot, like, for example, in cases where there's allegations of intentional conduct and negligence, and the attorney trying, you don't have two attorneys trying a case. The attorney tries, fights every count, and then at the end, you determine what's covered, what isn't.
Your Honor, I agree that that's what would happen realistically, whoever was defending the case. I would prefer to, rather than counsel appointed by the county, that this be the Attorney General's office, because we're dealing with you know, what we're saying is a law enforcement. I defer back to what Justice Patterson did in Lavezzi, where, you know, it's kind of euphemistically, she issued a reservation of rights letter and said, listen, when you go farther down the road on this case, looking at the allegations that we have now, it appears to be law enforcement. If it turns out we're wrong, and it turns out that the county lost it because, or the prosecutor's office lost it because the county did something wrong with the storage, then we're free to reconsider this, and you're free to say, no, the facts as developed show that it wasn't law enforcement. And so I think that's my point.
I said that's my point.
Just following up, if I may, on Justice Solomon's question, when a county prosecutor does not return a service weapon to a police officer accused of domestic violence, does the county prosecutor act under the authority of the Domestic Violence Act?
Yes, because what the Domestic Violence Act has a series of things, guidelines that what should happen in terms of the seizure of a weapon, and it spells out whether or not, you know, what you do in case there's a court order, what you do when there's a finding that domestic violence occurred, or in this case, what you do when there's been a seizure and there has been no domestic violence offense committed, no criminal charge or no court order. So that's all spelled out in.
But does that? But I mean, more specifically, as to a police officer, I certainly would presume that when people go out to an ordinary citizen's home and seize a gun, that's under the Domestic Violence Act. But when the county prosecutor, acting as a supervisor of law enforcement within the county, declines to return a service weapon to a police officer in DV, is the county prosecutor acting under the authority of the DV Act or under the legislative grant of authority to oversee law enforcement in that county, or some combination of the two, or some other thing? See, you see what I'm talking about?
I think I do, Your Honor, and I would
because
say
because
that
the weapon is issued by the municipality to the police officer. It's not a weapon that somebody went out and bought at a gun shop. It's for the police officer's use in the course of his or her duties. So where is the authority to not return it coming from?
I believe it's coming from the directive. I believe the Attorney General has given the county prosecutors, pursuant to the directive, even in a situation where there has been no court order, where there has been no criminal charge or civil charge of domestic violence, if the county prosecutor believes it's not safe to return a weapon to a law enforcement officer, under the directive, the county prosecutor is entitled to issue that type of decision. And if I may just kind of segue off of that, Your Honor.
Are you suggesting that the county prosecutor, who's the chief law enforcement officer in the county, does not have the authority to seize a police officer's weapon outside the realm of the Domestic Violence Act if the county prosecutor believes, due to infractions, violations, or whatever, that individual officer poses a danger if equipped with a service revolver?
Absolutely, the county prosecutor has that authority, Your Honor.
And that's outside of the Domestic Violence Act, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
And he's had
that authority. But that's not what the allegations are here.
Forever.
As I wouldn't consider myself an absolute authority on prosecutors' powers, but I believe you are correct that that's part of the prosecutor's inherent authority over law enforcement.
May I come back, if I can, to your second prong of your test? Because the language that you're using, and you're being probed a little bit on that right now, is language used in Wright to determine whether or not vicarious liability would attach to the state. It was a wholly distinct part of the Wright analysis from the indemnification analysis. And I wonder if you are inadvertently narrowing the indemnification analysis as it started out in Wright by incorporating vicarious liability standards into the decision for indemnification.
Your Honor, I'm certainly not trying to intentionally or inadvertently narrow Wright in any way. It's my understanding that what the court held in Wright was that normally there's two different standards, for example, in an insurance context, as to when there's a duty to defend and when there's a duty to indemnify, and they might be different standards. That
correct.
What the court found in Wright was that those two are conjoined for purposes of a tort claims analysis in terms of what's law enforcement and how we're going to determine whether or not a county prosecutor is entitled to indemnification and defense. That there is no separate, duty to defend, duty to indemnify. What the court found was that they're one. So I'm certainly not trying to suggest in any way that Wright limited law enforcement or not trying to narrow the court's holding in any way. I'm suggesting that the court intended it to be very broad. And it, again, as I think I responded to Justice Albin, not limited to context that we would normally see in federal cases dealing with either 11th Amendment issues or qualified or absolute immunity issues. It's much broader than that. And I think that's what the court in Wright was trying to set forth. And I think my argument is that what the Attorney General has done in this case is to try to narrow Wright's holding and done so improperly, and in doing so, denied a defense and indemnification to the prosecutor's office.
Do you draw any distinction under your analysis between an alleged failure by the county prosecutor's office not to investigate domestic violence and a judgment call by the county prosecutor that this particular individual, this employee of mine, should not have a weapon or the weapon may be retained?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that perhaps we're talking about two different sets of authorities. As Justice Albin said, doesn't a county prosecutor always have the right take a law enforcement person's weapon if they believe that that person is a danger to himself or another? And I think, as I responded, I believe they do have that power. I think what this case is about, though, it is a subset of that, where there is specific guidance from the Attorney General saying you will do this, as opposed to you can do this, or you may do this, or you have the authority to do this. What the Attorney General is saying is, I want a unified response to domestic violence claims involving law enforcement officers. So I am directing you, county prosecutors, to do this when you have these situations. So I think it's a subset of the bigger issues. And in this particular subset that we're dealing with, you have a situation where the Attorney General has said, here's what you're going to do. Now,
is that an oversimplification of what the guidance from the Attorney General in this situation is? Does a county prosecutor simply need to look at the directive and say, okay, I fall under this, here's the answer, no further consideration is required? It's all laid out, all covered, all dictated.
No, Your Honor. Obviously, a county prosecutor is still obligated to do an investigation, to interact with the municipality where the particular officer, if they're not a county officer, the municipality where the individual is working, and it falls outside. So, for example, if you have an officer who lives in Monmouth County but works in Ocean County, you have to coordinate with that county prosecutor as well. So, no, it's not just the check off the box that you have to do an investigation. You have to coordinate. You have to you know, make a law enforcement determination as to whether or not there's an issue here, and if so, what's the appropriate remedy, using the directive in terms of what you should be doing. But I don't think it's as simple as just, you know, here's the directive, that's the end of the discussion. You still have to exercise your law enforcement authority to investigate and make determinations in terms of what the appropriate remedies are in that particular case.
Is there a difference to be acknowledged when the determination as to whether to take a gun from an officer arises as a result of disciplinary infractions or some psychological indicia that has shown itself to call into question a person's fitness for duty, as opposed to what we had here, an outside victim of domestic violence filing complaint after complaint, having been threatened, harmed by this individual, and countless, well, it can't be counted, but numerous instances where intercession had to occur in order to protect the complainant. Does that provide a demarcation as to when we're dealing with taking a gun away from an officer at a county prosecutor's direction, potentially here?
I believe the answer is yes, Your Honor, because, you know, if you have obviously this case arises with a particular set of facts, and, you know, so if you're talking hypothetically about a different set of facts where you have an officer who, there's no domestic violence, that we're not talking about this particular directive, but we're talking about an officer who for some reason is sent for a fitness for duty evaluation and does not pass that fitness for duty evaluation, certainly then the prosecutor has the right, if not the obligation, to disarm that individual until they can be declared fit for duty. So I think there's a standard that would apply to those cases that is outside the directive. This case, you know, falls within the directive because, as Your Honor points out, the factual situation, involved domestic violence involving a law enforcement officer.
Your position, if I understand it, is it's of course a classic law enforcement function for the county prosecutor to proceed with the allegation of domestic violence and to investigate it thoroughly. I don't think there's any dispute among the parties as to that. And just the same, it's a classic law enforcement function for the county prosecutor to determine whether an employee may retain a weapon when there is a DV allegation of the nature of the case we have here.
That's correct, Your Honor. I would point out two things. I think the appellate division, in rendering its decision on page 14, applied the wrong standard. The appellate division applied a standard based on New Jersey Statute 2C25-21D1, which deals with the seizure of weapons in domestic violence cases generally, having nothing to do with law enforcement. And that was the standard that the Attorney General said it used. And that's the wrong legal standard to use. And I believe the appellate division erred when it upheld the Attorney General's use of that standard. There is a specific directive that supersedes that statute as it applies to law enforcement officers who are charged with domestic violence. And so I think, you know, that's one thing that this should consider in analyzing what it should do, that, you know, there is a general statute that deals with how we deal with weapons or how a county prosecutor deals with weapons in domestic violence cases. And that's statutorily created. But that's not the standard that to be applied in this case, because the Attorney General superseded and said, when we have a law enforcement officer, this is what I want you to do.
Although, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I just have one question, and my last question. Although we are deciding an indemnification issue here, however we decide this case will determine whether or not Judge Shipp dismisses a claim or keeps a claim. If we accept your arguments, he's going to dismiss a bunch of claims based upon 11th Amendment immunity. I'm only asking this question to see what the consequences of our decision will be. Am I correct about that?
I mean, certainly that would be my expectation, Your Honor. But I don't think this court should make a determination.
I'm not suggesting that we should. I'm just trying to figure out what the consequences are. I'm not saying that we should be guided by those consequences. I just want to know what they are. Am I correct?
You are correct, Your Honor. I mean, Judge Schiff has already indicated that, you know, the claims that are law enforcement have been dismissed with prejudice. So if this court were to say that we find that this is all law enforcement, I think the next application to Judge Shipp would be, whether it's by the Attorney General or by, you know, my office, would be, you know, Your Honor, this complaint should be dismissed as to these parties. Now, you know, he may well say, well, there's still certain claims that I find remain, but I can't predict what Judge Shipp is going to do, but I tend to agree with Your Honor that, yes, there will be consequences in that underlying litigation. The other issue that is puzzling in terms of the Attorney General's position is its statement that in all its letters denying coverage, that the training and supervision of law enforcement officers is not a law enforcement function, while at the same time, in the underlying litigation, arguing to Judge Shipp that it was. So I'm not aware of any cases that deal with training and supervision in terms of right, as to whether or not this court or an appellate court has held that training and supervision is a classic law enforcement function. There are numerous federal cases that say that it is. The Attorney General, as I said, in its brief to dismiss the law enforcement claims in the underlying case, said that it was training and supervision was classic law enforcement. So, you know, in terms of all of the allegations that are contained in the various complaints, I think it's clear that, you know, broadly, they're all law enforcement. They were all intended to be covered by right. And that the Attorney General's decision not to cover all the claims was erroneous and should be reversed.
Ms. Geigel, just one more question following up on Justice Albin's question. Does the estate of the victim in this case understand the consequences that they're not before this court?
Your Honor, I can't answer that question. I have no idea as to, you know, what the estate knows or doesn't know, other than from, you know, reading their pleadings. You know, I can't tell you candidly, you know, what they know.
Have they been served with copies of the papers in this case, as far as you know?
The only way that I know they have some of the information, Your Honor, is that after the appellate division reversed in part the Attorney General's decisions on the second and third amended complaints, the Attorney General then did file a subsequent letter amending and then came back into the federal litigation to move to dismiss. And so as part of that, the parties were made aware of, obviously, the appellate division decision, this underlying litigation, and what is transpiring, and knew that there was at that point, I believe it was a petition for certification that was pending. And so they would, you know, be aware that this has been going on. But there has been no effort on anyone's part to formally serve them with copies of anything in this court that I'm aware of.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Vanilla.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. The court held in Wright versus State that county prosecutorial employees are state employees for purposes of the Tort Claims Act only when they investigate, arrest, and prosecute people for criminal offenses. When a county prosecutor is sued for malicious prosecution of a criminal offense or for negligent handling of a criminal prosecution, for purposes of the Tort Claims Act, the state is liable and must defend and indemnify. When a county detective is sued for false arrest or excessive force or negligence in conducting a criminal arrest or investigation, for purposes of the Tort Claims Act, the state is liable and must defend and indemnify. But when county employees become involved in the supervision or management of local police, that is not the type of activity for purposes of the Tort Claims Act for which the state is liable and must defend and indemnify. That includes administrative investigations of police, administrative seizures of police officer weapons, and more generally, training and oversight provided to local police departments. County's position in this appeal, if it is accepted, would rewrite the Wright decision. And because it would expand the Tort Claims Act's definition of state employee, it would shift liability to the state for claims that traditionally have been directed against other entities and continue to have been in the 19 years since Wright was decided. The court thus should reject the county's position. And if you consider the arguments on which it relies, it is clear why the court should do so. The county relies on the Attorney General's supersession power, which the court did cite to, and his power to issue directives. But they place far too much weight on both of these. This is because the Attorney General's ability to influence county prosecutors' offices pursuant to the Criminal Justice Act encompasses virtually everything they do, even those things this court and other courts have definitively held fall outside of the state's obligation to defend and indemnify. He could supersede or assign a DAG or an AAG to a prosecutor's office in virtually any capacity that the prosecutor's office handles. He also can and has issued a number of law enforcement directives and guidelines that bind not just county prosecutors, but all law enforcement officers in the state. And as the court has already noted, these include directives on public records requests, as well as directives that guide personnel decisions, both of which undisputedly under case law precedent, county functions for Wright. But if you follow the county's logic, because the AG has these powers, the state would be obligated to defend and indemnify all county and local law enforcement officers for those functions and for virtually everything else they do. I know that the county added a nuance today that not all directives are necessarily determinative of under Wright, just the ones that are needed to instill statewide consistency, but that's what every directive that is issued is meant to do, is to create statewide uniformity in the performance of a particular function. So that is why the county's logic fails. Instead, Wright carved out only certain classic functions performed by county prosecutorial employees in order to harmonize the case law with statutes as well as public policy. We submit that that carve-out was intended to be narrow and limited, just as the Tort Claims Act's definition of state employee is narrow and limited. The court should continue to interpret it as such. As set out in our briefs, the prior state and federal law precedent on which we relied interpreted it as such. Wright also recognized that statutory authority holds the county responsible for paying all necessary expenses incurred by the prosecutor for each county in the detection, arrest, indictment, and conviction of offenders against the laws. Authorities on which Wright relied also reinforced that, notwithstanding the Attorney General's powers to issue directives and to supersede, the county maintains employer-employee relationships with the prosecutor's employees. If these authorities all just hold,
and they do, that the county is liable for employment and OBRA lawsuits despite their having some nexus with law enforcement, certainly these authorities can and do hold the county liable for any other lawsuits outside of the limited state carve-out. Therefore, we request that this court affirm the judgment of the appellate division. This concludes my opening statement. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Vanell, if I could start out, what is the Attorney General's position as to what claims, and I don't mean by number, by page, very long complaint, but what claims are left in this case after Judge Shipp's dismissal with prejudice of the law enforcement related claims?
Well, my understanding, Your Honor, is despite making that ruling in the first round of the motions to dismiss, it's still not clear what claims are still active because we're still in the motion to dismiss stage. But I would submit that, and there's still a third motion to dismiss the third amended complaint pending, which the DAG as well as County Council are both involved in. But we would submit that following that decision, what should be left, if anything, the claims that against the county prosecutor's employees that the AG denied right representation indemnification to. So the claims relating to the return of the service weapon and the claims relating to this alleged supervision or oversight that the county prosecutor had, Officer Seidel or other local police officers who were involved in the incident. We anticipate that the claims that our office agreed to represent and indemnify, which are still pending in front of Judge Shipp, are not only classic law enforcement functions, but separately from that are allegations that should be entitled to prosecutorial immunity, although that is an issue of interpretation of federal common law, not right. We anticipate those claims should be dismissed, however, based on that immunity. And to answer another question that was asked of Ms. Geigel, the 11th Amendment would only, if anything, dismiss claims against the county prosecutor's office. And that is if Judge Shipp accepts that the claims that are being directed against the prosecutor's office that relate to the classic law enforcement functions. In that scenario, the prosecutor's office would be considered an arm of the state, and therefore, just as the state would have 11th Amendment immunity, the county prosecutor's office would be dismissed. That in itself would not dismiss any other claims against the individual officials because there could be individual liability claims against them.
If I may follow up, is there, what is the AG's position as to whether there is any daylight between claims that are subject to 11th Amendment immunity for the state and claims as to which the Attorney General must and will defend and indemnify in this case?
I think our position is and has been since Wright came out is that any claims directed against a prosecutor's office, the entity itself, or official capacity claims against prosecutors' employees that are classic law enforcement functions and therefore state functions under Wright should be entitled to 11th Amendment immunity because if those same claims were directed against, say, my office, which is 100% a state office, that office would have 11th Amendment immunity. But the Attorney General or a prosecutor in Division of Criminal Justice can always be sued in their individual capacity, and whether those claims survive depends not on the 11th Amendment, but on entirely separate doctrines of absolute prosecutorial immunity or qualified immunity. So, in short, Wright or the court's decision in this case have no bearing on whether claims against individual employees are entitled to absolute or qualified immunity.
It also depends upon whether or not the individual is classified as acting in his official capacity or individual capacity. If in his official capacity, then he or she is the alter ego of the entity and would have 11th Amendment immunity. Am I correct about that?
You're correct, Justice Alvin. My understanding of how these cases are litigated is it doesn't take much for a court to assume, at least at the pleading stage, that a plaintiff is suing any, it could be any official, let's say the county prosecutorial employees in this case, both in their official and individual capacity. So where, while the official capacity claims might be dismissed based on 11th Amendment, as long as they're being sued in their personal or individual capacities, those claims would still survive.
So when you, Mr. Vanello, when you are referring to classic law enforcement functions, are you tying that to defense of specific claims, investigation of specific complaints? How broadly does that term go in the AG's implementation of this indemnification obligation under Wright?
I don't know that we have a, I don't know that we would say as a bright line rule that it has to be tied to an individual investigation, but I think that's a fair way to look at it, because when you're talking about investigation, prosecution, arrest, you're talking about something specific. I think our interpretation that would be narrower than one that I think you suggested, Justice LaVecchia, that under Wright, what the state is liable for under the Tort Claims Act and has to defend, indemnify, is specifically investigations of crimes. The prosecutor has an abundant level of autonomy that has been long recognized even before the Criminal Justice Act of 1970, as does the Attorney General. The Criminal Justice Act kind of sinks the two levels of authority. The attorney or the county prosecutors have a lot of authority to do the sort of things that we deny defense indemnification for and always have regarding oversight of local police departments. What we see in this case, one of the allegations and what has been coming up, speaking as someone who is familiar with the Wright requests and the lawsuits from which they derive from the past three or so years, we're seeing more and more claims that because the county prosecutors are chief law enforcement officers of the county, they have oversight over all local police departments. So therefore, they're liable just for allowing bad practices to go uncorrected or because they were in a position where they might have done something. That's not tied to a specific investigation. We would say certainly that is not something for which the state government under Wright is required to defend and indemnify. And as we take in the position in this case, that includes any internal affairs investigation that the county prosecutor might become involved with, whether it's regardless of the authority on which it derives.
Mr. Vanello, is it your contention that enforcement, Chief, you can go first. I'll wait.
You go ahead.
Is it your contention that enforcement of the Domestic Violence Act, and in this case, against a particular law enforcement officer, is or is not a law enforcement function?
We would say that it's, so that's part of what we disagree with on the county. It's one thing to say it's a law enforcement function. I would say just about anything the prosecutor does is a law enforcement function, but the issue in Wright.
I'm not talking about that. I'm saying the enforcement of the Domestic Violence Act, limited to the facts of this case, against a particular law enforcement officer, is that or is that not a law enforcement function? We can parse the individual acts later.
I would agree that's clearly enforcement of the law. That's a law enforcement function.
Your colleague has argued to us that retention or a decision by the county prosecutor whether an employee can retain or whether a weapon must be seized in the context of pointed domestic violence allegations as we have in this case is no different from the classic law enforcement decision about investigation, prosecution, arrest. Can you speak to that?
I would say there is no difference if it was seized as part of an arrest or as part of the bringing of a criminal charge. But prosecutors are involved with more than just criminal investigations and criminal charges. And as this case shows, there are situations where the prosecutor's office may, either on its own initiative or pursuant to the Domestic Violence Act or the Attorney General's directive, may seize weapons when there is no criminal charge that will result from it. And within the case of law enforcement officers, there's a reason for that. And it's not just because we only want to deal with the officers who have or are about to commit a crime, but you're dealing with a class of people who, unlike most people in the state, are authorized to not only possess but use weapons, but like anyone might, you know, be subject to situations in their personal life where access to that weapon, you know, would create a great danger. And as part of the general oversight that the county prosecutors have, part of that is to ensure that officers are not allowed to get to that situation where they might actually commit a crime. In this case, we denied Wright for, to the extent that they seized his weapon and they were conducting basically administrative function. They were part of the fitness for duty evaluation. We would say that as far that is outside and separate from a scenario where they might seize a weapon because they arrested Officer Seidel for actually committing crime, whether it's domestic violence crime or weapons crime.
But would you concede, Mr. Vanella, that this is a much closer case than a situation where an officer is just in the normal course of his duties or her duties is behaving in a manner that creates concern about his mental health generally? I mean, we have here a DV history alleged, which does implicate the Domestic Violence Act. And I would suggest makes it different from a situation where the supervising officers are observing behavior and speech of the officer that's giving people concern in the police station that perhaps he's not fit for duty and starts an administrative process. You see what I mean? You've got a real DV aspect to this, which is statutory and which is law enforcement.
Well, I can't disagree that the Domestic Violence Act is part of Title IIc. As we argued, domestic violence investigations are not solely criminal investigations. They can be brought either way. I would certainly agree that there is a, to the extent that domestic violence can be considered a crime, it's certainly closer to a criminal investigation than other scenarios that you mentioned, Justice Patterson. We would still argue that there's still a clear distinction between this and an actual criminal investigation.
So one of the claims on which you have declined to defend is failing to properly supervise, monitor, train, retain, and discipline officers, which is a classic line in a civil rights complaint. And if the failure to supervise, monitor, train, and discipline has to do with an officer who has, let's say, repeatedly, recklessly fired his weapon, and then on the sixth occasion winds up killing someone, is that a law enforcement function? Is it an administrative function to not have acted? Take it away.
So part of the problem with this case, I'll just preface this by saying, is when we get a Wright request, and to be fair, the county has a similar dilemma, we have to assume that all the allegations are true and actually can result in liability. Part of the problem is you're dealing with allegations like this where it's not clear, at least to me, that whether a prosecutor is a county employee or state employee, that they have any liability for failure to supervise someone who's not their actual employee, meaning local police officers. So the first issue we have to deal with is whether that is actually an actionable claim. We have to assume at this point that it is. Our position, again, is that Wright only puts the state liable for criminal investigations and prosecutions. It's an either or. We believe that when the court decided Wright, it was saying that there are certain things that the state would have to defend, indemnify for, and other things that the county would. If it's not the state, it's the county. And the reason for that is the limited stay carve-out, the narrow definition of state employee, as well as the statute that holds the county responsible for paying all necessary expenses. We're saying this is not a state function for purposes of the Tort Claims Act, and therefore it should fall on the county to defend and indemnify.
I pose this question to Ms. Geigel, but how we decide this case, if we accept your argument, more counties will be subject to lawsuits in federal court because they will not be protected by 11th Amendment immunity. That's one of the consequences of our indemnification decision here. Am I correct about that?
Well, first of all, we would argue that if the court rules in our favor, it would be maintaining what the status quo has been since Wright, which is to say that these sort of claims have continued to have been handled by the county. But I will add this, that even though the county, if the county itself were sued as an entity, which I believe the county is sued as an entity in this case, although I could be wrong, they're certainly sued in many other cases against county prosecutors' offices, of which I'm aware. Even though the county, Monmouth County in this case, would not have 11th Amendment immunity, they still would not have respondeat superior liability under Section 1983 as well. The county would still only be liable if the plaintiff could somehow show that the county itself committed a constitutional violation under the Monell case, meaning that they had some policy.
No, I agree with that. I think we understand that. But the further we accept your argument, the more we take away 11th Amendment immunity from counties, correct? I'm not talking about Monell. Of course, they have Monell protection if they're in the case.
Well, I guess what I would say is the county never had 11th Amendment immunity, and I don't see that this would, however the court rules on this, would put more or less liability on the county itself, because
they didn't before Wright, but we now know that they're having 11th Amendment immunity because Judge Shipp is dismissing claims against the county. But before Wright, counties were sued in federal court. The further we expand Wright, the fewer counties are going to be sued in federal court because of 11th Amendment immunity. Am I mistaken about that?
I'm not sure that Judge Shipp, I could be wrong. I don't believe he dismissed any claims against Monmouth County based on 11th Amendment immunity. Like I said, I think the only question is whether the county prosecutor's office, which is itself a defendant, would be entitled to 11th Amendment immunity either in full or in part. And again, they would only be entitled to the extent that there are claims that relate to classic law enforcement functions. So either way, the claims against the county prosecutor's office are almost derivative of the claims against Prosecutor Grimaccioni and the three assistant prosecutors. In short, if plaintiff has a claim against any of them, the claims can be proven against those individuals. They almost don't need the county prosecutor's office. I don't know that I would agree that this court's decision would result in any real changes for the county itself as a defendant in future lawsuits.
Mr. Vanilla, is it common in the AG's review of complaints like what arose in this situation to review paragraph by paragraph and determine whether or not there'll be coverage for one paragraph versus another, and then make some overall determination about counts or the complaint as a whole? I can't say that I recall seeing the detail that I've seen here.
Well, so I've been a DAG in this office for about 10 years, and now an AAG justice. This is one of the more complex complaints that I've seen. They're usually much simpler, and there are a lot of different, there were hundreds of paragraphs and hundreds of different factual allegations. So to answer your question, we don't necessarily normally break things down by paragraph. I think the AAG who drafted this response and the AG's decision there was hopeful that this would make clearer what we were agreeing to defend and indemnify for rather than make it more confusing. But what I would disagree with in general about the county's position is it's almost as if they're saying, as long as there's one distinct claim or allegation in a complaint that clearly falls under right, whatever that is, then that means the state would have to pick up the entire complaint, at least until the end. I don't think that's necessary. I don't think that's correct under right. And while it may be not as easy to have two attorneys representing a defendant in a lawsuit, it's also far from a rare thing. It's been happening in this case. It happens on occasions in other right cases in which we are involved, as well as other non-right cases in which we are involved. I think for purposes of right, as long as we make clear what the claims are that we believe falls under the state's obligation and we are agreeing to defend, indemnify, that's all our obligation is. And if there's no uncertainty, like there was in Lavezzi, which this is not a situation where it appears to have been a classic law enforcement function, but we may not know something about the county's involvement. If we're correct that this is failure to supervise a local police officer is not a classic law enforcement function, there is nothing that can change that based on whatever may come out in discovery. So this is relatively detailed, but it's not the only time we've done something like this with the right decision.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Vanilla?
No, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Ms. Geigel, brief rebuttal.
Very brief, Your Honor. In terms of the last point that Justice LaVecchia raised and the paragraph-by-paragraph analysis, it has set up an interesting dynamic where the Attorney General's office and my office, not me, but someone else from my office who is representing the county prosecutor defendants in the underlying case are actually in conflict with each other because the AG is trying to limit what is law enforcement as opposed to you know, our position, which is everything is law enforcement. So just from a logistical standpoint, not only do we have the issue that we talked about before in terms of how do you defend a case where there's multiple paragraphs or clauses within paragraphs, and no particular counts that the AG is saying it's covered. But you also have a situation where counsel, although representing, the same parties, are not on the same page. So it's a very difficult.
There's no way to avoid that. Is there, counsel, there's no way to avoid that. Based on your suggestion, and the AG's office has to have roll over and consider everything's covered, because if they object to anything, they're in a conflict with your position. It's unavoidable when you have a situation like this that there'll be a conflict. It happens even in civil cases. There's an allegation of intentional act, an allegation of negligence. There's always a conflict. It can't be resolved unless the Attorney General rolls over and says everything's covered.
I'm not saying they should roll over. I'm saying it is covered, Justice. But I mean,
if you're wrong, and there's a conflict, they couldn't defend because then the defense itself creates the conflict. So it would prevent them from raising any type of objection to coverage.
But when you have the classic situation where, let's take the insurance context, where there are covered claims and non-covered claims, you go through with one counsel, and to the extent that there's an ultimate determination that something resulted in liability, you handle indemnification issues differently. So that
it's a separate lawsuit. The coverage suit's always separate. You don't try them at the same time. So there's no need to, a defense attorney in a negligence or intentional act case defends his client as to all claims. There was no negligence, there was no intentional act. The issue later becomes a separate coverage law, a declaratory judgment action, a DEC action. So it doesn't come up.
And again, going back to Justice Patterson and Lavezzi, that's basically what she said there, which was, look, it's early on in this case, but the genesis of this case is in law enforcement, so we should provide coverage, or the AG should provide coverage. And if it turns out something later on shows that the county was responsible, well, that can be addressed. Same thing here. This arises out of a law enforcement context. And so the genesis of these claims is law enforcement. And so the Attorney General should cover. If it turns out later on that there were items that should not have been the AG's responsibility, then that can be the subject of a separate lawsuit between the AG and the county.
The conflict you're talking about is that if Mr. Vanella and you are both before Judge Shipp and his argument is accepted, your client is going to wind up in the case. Your client is going to wind up remaining on the ledger sheet, correct? Because
yes,
he's arguing, hey, the county was acting in an administrative capacity. They should remain in the 1983 lawsuit.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, has it happened so far that two attorneys are standing up for the same client before Judge Shipp and taking different positions on a question like just as Albin just posed?
It's been a little bit more nuanced than that, Your Honor, but the answer is yes, because after the second amended complaint, after the first amended complaint, when all parties filed motions to dismiss, the Attorney General filed a motion to dismiss, but said, we're only moving to dismiss on law enforcement issues. My office filed a much broader motion to dismiss.
On behalf of the same client.
On behalf of the client. When that motion was granted and Judge Shipp said, everything that's law enforcement or dealing with the Monmouth County Prosecutor's Office is dismissed with prejudice. Thereafter, the AG's office has said, well, we're not in this case anymore. Despite the fact that the same allegations remained in the next complaint, the allegations that the AG's office said they were covering. So they just kind of washed their hands of it and said, well, we're out. And you know, as I said, the appellate division's decision has the chart showing that those very same factual allegations were still in the second amended complaint that the Attorney General said, no, we're not defending it.
But doesn't that problem go away to some degree when the judge rules on the current motion that's pending? And decides, as I understand that motion, what's really law enforcement and what's not in the new complaint?
Justice Patterson, I don't know that Judge Shipp is inclined at this point to determine what is law enforcement and what is not. I don't want to speak for Judge Shipp, but certainly he has not shown an interest so far in going that route. We're at the very early stages, procedurally at least, in that case, in that, you know, no answer has been filed there, you know, by the county defendants. There have just been motions to dismiss. So I think the more likely result is that whatever this court decides will impact Judge Shipp in terms of how he handles things.
On that point, and we touched on this at the end of your first argument, in light of the consequences, if you prevail here, shouldn't the estate and the children have received at least a courtesy copy of the papers in this litigation so that they could make a determination what to do, just as a matter of basic fairness?
Your Honor, I mean, the honest answer is, as I said, I know they're aware of it because it's been part of the pleading, but in terms of providing a courtesy copy, it's not, honestly, not something that I thought about. The argument for us was with the Attorney General's office. So to be
clear, I'm not suggesting any bad motives here at all.
No, just I understand.
What should we do at this point is the question.
I, with all due respect to counsel for the estate, I mean, clearly their position, I think, as Justice Albin has said, is going to be that this is all administrative. And so really, I don't know that their input is important to the court's decision. In fact, it might be better for the court to decide it in the vacuum that you're in, because you you can't make a decision based on what will happen in the underlying case. You have to make a decision based on what is the law according to Wright and Lavezzi, and how those chips fall from there. You know, while I understand there will be chips that fall from there, and I'm not trying to be glib in any way, but that can't be this court's concern, just like it shouldn't be the Attorney General's concern when making these decisions, or anyone else's.
We have the estate's allegation and the children's allegation that this is all administrative in the complaint.
Justice Patterson, it is in their Third Amendment complaint. You're correct.
Just spent an hour and 20 minutes teasing out that one paragraph, and that's why I asked the question. There is some benefit to oral argument, as I'm sure both counsel would argue, and we're not hearing anything from the estate except for the few words they've included in paragraph 47.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honors. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.